Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name.
Good morning and welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, so glad that you could join me and set aside some time for my program this morning, The Cross in the Desert. It is Monday. It is the very last week in February. There is hope for most of us who are just dying for the first day of spring, who are snowbound, icebound, who are trying to thaw out and dig out, I guess, from the harsh winter weather. Right here where I live in Florissant, we've had a few inches of snow, a little ice here and there, nothing compared to the East Coast. So I know most of us are counting down the days. In fact, actually, just in about 2 weeks, the time change will take place. So there is hope on the way, and I know all of us are looking forward to that. Well, talking about dire circumstances and harsh conditions, today's program, it is dedicated to the real war on women. What I mean is there is a political back and forth between liberals and conservatives about the issue of women's rights. We go through this every day through every election cycle. We hear about this term, the war on women. But I have news for you. The real war on women is really in many places, not just here. It's in the Middle East particularly. And today we're going to focus in on the Yazidis. They are a group of people living in Iraq that were tortured, raped, and kidnapped by ISIS, that evil terrorist entity in Iraq and Syria that's trying to take over the world, converting it to their brand, if you will, of Islam. But I want to talk today about this issue because it needs to be addressed as much as possible. The war on women is nothing new. I'm sure you know about this. I was just talking to a friend. She's an author. Her name is Claire. And she was giving me a little bit of insight into the history of how women have been oppressed during different time periods, during different campaigns of military groups and things like that. And they would walk into cities, conquer it, take over women, and just do horrible things to them. So this is really nothing new. And this is the practice of ISIS in particular that we're focusing in on. But I have a copy of my book in front of me called The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. And on the front cover is a picture of Rahane Jabari. Rahane, if you've listened to my program, you know about her. Rahane Jabari was executed back on October 25th in Tehran. Her crime was defending herself against a rapist. And this is a very long and involved story, but the gist of it is she was hired to go and help a man redo his office. She was an interior designer, decorator, as well as a computer programmer. And what happened was when he drove her there, he drove her to an empty building and attempted to rape her. He was a former intelligence agent for the Iranian regime. And, of course, that factored in on her punishment. They didn't believe her story. They thought it was completely false when she stabbed and killed him, you know, defending herself against a rape attack. They never believed Rahane's story. And eventually Even the day of her execution, they brought in a camera crew, wanted to force her to recant her testimony and tell the truth, and perhaps she would be spared. And Rahane, of course, said, "I will never do that." So I dedicated my book to Rahane, which is another example of the war on women. Women in Iran, of course, are second-class citizens, possessions for the most part. Their testimony is equal to half that of a man, according to the Quran, and they are treated in such a way. And I had to dedicate my book to her and wrote a couple blogs because she is the focus of what I do in Iran, the way women are treated. And as I think today of the Yazidis, and I think of the way they have been treated, and the many people down through the ages, the many women, I just feel as though it's very strongly in my spirit to once again raise this issue to us and help us to understand what's going on. But I want to do something in addition to that today. I want to talk about a foundation called the Free Yazidi Foundation that is doing things that are wonderful, giving hope to traumatized victims of rape and of violence, and specifically the Yazidi people. And we're going to talk about that later. So we're not just going to deal with the core of the issue. We're not just going to focus in and spotlight what I'm sure you've heard about in the news. We're also, today on The Cross in the Desert, going to offer an opportunity for you, as a listener, to hook up with this foundation and do what you can to do to bring awareness or funding to these tortured and traumatized people that have escaped, thankfully, from the clutches of ISIS. So stay tuned. We're going to do that later. I want to talk at length about this because, again, the issues we've all heard about, what about something you and I can do to make a difference? And that's what we're going to talk about a little later. Now, some good news here for the Cross in the Desert. Hopefully, I'm not sure about this. I will find out Wednesday. I got a very, very special guest that might be on my program this coming Thursday. Her name is Lisa Daftari. She is a journalist, an expert on counterterrorism and the Middle East issues. She's Iranian Jewish, and she works at Fox News. And it would just be a delight to have her on for an interview this Thursday, but I don't know that for sure. I'm still planning and working with that, and she will let me know, and I hope that we can do this. But don't go and say it's going to happen for sure because I don't know that, and we're hoping and working in behind the scenes for that to happen. But we're going to have Lisa's voice today, and she's going to talk about what ISIS is doing to recruiting women. We're also going to have a very good friend on my program in an interview called Muslims' Reaction to ISIS. Her name is Zainab Khan. She has been on The Cross in the Desert a couple of times, and we're going to have an interview recorded from her. She will be on, hopefully, next Thursday. Things are, you know, takes time to develop. People have schedules and lives, and we're working behind the scenes to get some of the most prominent, powerful women in media to talk about these issues. And so that's why I've asked Lisa Daftari and Zainab Khan to come back on The Cross in the Desert and lend their voice and expertise on the issue of violence against women. Zainab, of course, appeared in Honor Diaries. If you've seen Honor Diaries, a tremendous documentary, Muslim women speaking up against atrocities committed against them. It's a documentary you must see. You will watch it again and again. And so Zainab was a part of that, and she hopefully will be on in a couple of weeks to talk about what ISIS is doing about the selling of human organs and what their global intent is against women in the Middle East. So we'll have her hopefully very soon as well, too. I want to begin today on The Cross in the Desert. A great program over the weekend. Judge Jeannie Perino was not there, and Katie Pavlich took the helm and had some very interesting topics relating to our program today. The first up we're going to hear from is Lisa Daftari, and she talks about ISIS recruiting women right here on The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
Questions surrounding three schoolgirls from the UK who boarded a flight to Turkey in what's believed to be a common flight path towards ISIS in Syria. These images are from Gatwick Airport just outside London. The girls, two of whom are 15, the other 16, all attend the same school in East London. But apparently, no one at the airport questioned why the three young girls were traveling without any adult supervision to Turkey and possibly Syria. And earlier today, the parents of these young girls sent out pleas on social media for them to come home, and Prime Minister David Cameron also voiced his concern.
Well, it is deeply concerning, and obviously our authorities will do everything we can to help these girls, but it does make a broader point, which is the fight against Islamist extremist terror is not just one that we can wage by the police and border control. It needs every school, every university, every college, every community to recognize they have a role to play. We all have a role to play in stopping people from having their minds poisoned by this appalling death cult.
And with me now, terrorism analyst and Fox News contributor, Lisa Daftari. Lisa, thanks so much for coming in tonight.
Pleasure.
First, let's talk about these three girls. How did these authorities actually find out that they were gone and missing and on their way to Turkey and probably ultimately Syria?
Their parents actually alerted authorities when they realized that they said they were going to school and they actually didn't come home, and that's where they were going. They're still believed to be in Turkey and have not yet crossed over into ISIS territory, into Syria, and authorities are obviously, they know that time is of the essence because it's much easier to find them in Turkey rather than wait until they are in Syria.
How is it that these young women who aren't even legal adults yet are able to get on an airplane flight at a time when we're watching ISIS closely and even get to Turkey without going unnoticed, essentially?
Right, absolutely. And this is something that obviously the ISIS is masterful at doing, recruiting, radicalizing, luring these young women, which is now their target group, young women from the West, to go over there to become ISIS brides, to become ISIS girlfriends, to either be sold for a profit or to actually become part of this growing caliphate. They want ISIS wives, husbands, babies, families. They want to grow the caliphate.
I have seen that there are at least 50 women from the UK who have gone to be wives of ISIS fighters. I've also seen that 1 in 6 of the recruits that ISIS is taking are women. I mean, this is a huge number, but what is the actual reality for these women once they get over? Because as you said, ISIS puts up this really appealing way of living in Syria, but in reality it's much different.
Right, so they promise this Islamic utopia. They go over there and they realize Sharia law reality. And what happens is it's very difficult once they are there to come back because they're an asset for ISIS. Again, not only are they wives and serve as sex slaves or what have you, but now they have Western passports in their possession. So it's very difficult once they get there. And we see both scenarios play out. Some act as a platform then, you becoming a propaganda tool and asking other women to come serve your religion, come join ISIS, and others who are absolutely regretful.
Yeah, well, I want to switch gears a little bit here. We've talked about women and other fighters going to Syria, but now the concern is that Syrian refugees actually being invited to the United States to seek asylum. What can you tell us about that?
Right, this is an absolute mistake. We've already seen the fallout from letting these refugees come, whether it's in Europe or right here in the United States in the aftermath of 9/11 or the Boston Marathon bombing. Look, we are a nation. We have heart. We want to let these refugees in. A lot of them are well-intentioned. A lot of them are religious minorities. They're Christians. We want to let them in. But at what cost? When we do not have the proper apparatus to vet these individuals, then who are we to let them in and then take a risk at that? The irony in all of this is that the reason this administration did not get involved in the Syrian civil war is that we said we could not figure out who the good guys and the bad guys were. Now, are we going to take a chance to let those bad guys in with the good guys here in this country?
Well, what is that? That's my question, is what is the vetting process that they actually have set up? I know that there's been a lot of criticism of the amount of students we've let in from Saudi Arabia because they overstay their visas, and there's thousands of students now lost in the system who we haven't followed up on. And now we're seeing this refugee crisis, which is 4 million people, and it doesn't seem like they can even handle that large of a number, unfortunately.
No, we cannot, and we don't have the apparatus on the ground in Syria in terms of getting intel. Again, remember the red line and how we drew it and how we couldn't get involved because we just did not have the proper intel. And again, we've already seen the fallout from letting these types of individuals in. We have to take a step back and say, as much as we want to be the nation that provides haven for these unfortunate cases, at the same time, we prioritize national security. Mm-hmm. And that's the bottom line.
Absolutely. National security for the United States comes first. Lisa,
absolutely.
Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate it. And coming up, the latest on the...
Lisa Daftari, Fox News with Katie Pavlich, sitting in for Judge Jeannie Perino. A lot of issues raised there in this mini report, things that just pertain to you and me. First of all, there is a sifting process with immigration, and propaganda and infiltration is the biggest tools besides deception that ISIS uses. If they can gain the passports of these three young women and they can use it in creating false identities and infiltrate into the United States via Syrian refugees, think of the possibility of sleeper cells, of ISIS members? Are those sympathetic to them? Think about the possibilities of what could happen to you and me. You know, we sit in our comfortable home and we watch these cruel and horrible beheadings, but think of the reality of what could happen if they infiltrate through propaganda and identity theft and make their way into our borders through Syrian refugees. There is so much here to be concerned about. Our homeland security, our immigration has to be working hand in hand and be very, very vigilant and observant if we let people in. You know, I think of my Iranian friends, and of course I don't know them intimately. None of us knows anyone on Facebook intimately, if you will. And so my biggest dream is that my Iranian friends come here to have a life of hope and freedom. And yet when I hear a report like this, it makes me pause and think, wait a minute. How well do I know the ones I talk to? Well, it's the same issue when it comes to immigration and granting a visa, background checks, understanding something about this person's background, their affiliations. All of that is determined in immigration status and reports for visas, passports, etc. There is so much information out there. There is so much deception out there. You never know who you're letting into your borders. And so it's a very difficult process. And as I think of my dear friends, I really believe I know them, but they have to go through the sifting process too. They have to be checked out thoroughly too. And so when I think about the Syrian refugees, think about those that are really, really passionate for freedom, and they want to come here to have a new life and a new dream. And our hearts go out to these people, but you have to make sure, you have to know who you're letting in, because you're dealing with a terrorist caliphate like ISIS that wants to, as they said, raise their flag, the flag of Allah at the White House. If we look at that and say, yeah, right, really? Do we really, really want to have that attitude? Do we really, really want to think that way? These people in ISIS are dead serious. They want to do what they boast and claim they want to do. And so I think we need to be vigilant, and we need to be very strong, and we need to be very discerning. And so when I hear about these three young women going over the borders of Turkey to Syria to join the ISIS caliphate, what on earth would possess them to think that this is some grand and glorious new life? Don't they watch the news? Don't they see what's happening? And I just, it's incredible to think that they would even entertain the idea. But that is the world we live in. So much gullibility and deception going on a daily basis. Well, that's Lisa Daftari. I hope and pray that we can have her on the Cross in the Desert this Thursday. I want to take us to another report. This is from my good friend Zainab Khan. I talked to you a little bit about her background, being part of Honor Diaries. She is a strong and powerful voice for human rights for women. And recently, she was on with Katie Pavlich. She actually followed Lisa. And she talked about the Muslim reaction to ISIS. We're going to hear from Zainab right now on the Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
And with me now for a reaction is Zainab Khan. She is an activist for the global women's rights movement and a women's delegate for the United Nations. Thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you so much.
So you were recently in London. Tell us about your experience. Is Lord Malcolm Pearson correct in his assessment?
I absolutely agree with him. I think that he covers several key points, and one of them is being that there is a deep ostracization of reformist Muslims, progressive Muslims speaking out because there is a deep fear. There's a lot of backlash that's associated with it. The minute you tie the theological component to the radical ideologies that do exist there, you are immediately labeled as an Islamophobe. Mm-hmm. And this cuts the dialogue from any sort of progressive movement that can be done. And we've seen this happen even when we're seeing continuous human rights violations with women, girls, mm-hmm. children, time and time again. And the term Islamophobia is always thrown the minute you begin to question, the minute you begin to ask why, what is the justification, and a lot of times the justification is theological, mm-hmm. and it has been there. This isn't anything new. These laws have been codified for centuries,
right?
And now ISIS is acting up on them, and we're reacting when really it's been there for mm-hmm. quite a while.
And it's certainly made its way into the West. I was also in London recently, and just a couple of days before the Copenhagen shootings happened, I attended a mm-hmm. anti-free speech Islamic protest in London, just outside our parliament. I thought it was so interesting how they corralled off the women from the men at this protest. And they put the stage in the middle of the protest, and the all-male speakers turned their back to the women and only spoke to the men. Which brings me to my next question for you. You have some interesting information on an ISIS manifesto for women and girls. What can you tell us about what their plans are for them?
Oh, yeah. And this ISIS manifesto was actually written by their Al-Khamsa Brigade, which is all females. And they enforce these Sharia laws, but extreme versions of them, where it justifies girls to be married at the age of 9. Mm-hmm. It gives an entire doctrine of what a woman's role is, how she can support ISIS and the jihad against any non-believers. And these are laws that are continuously imposed, and if you go against them, even to the point of your dress, how you can't leave the house without a male, you know, companion. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, these are the same ideas and ideologies that are recruiting these women from the West to join ISIS as jihadist right.
Right. Well, now, you obviously have very strong connections to the UN. You have strong influence at the UN. What is the UN doing, not only to protect women and girls, but to stop the recruiting from ISIS, that those women and girls can be protected from getting into a bad situation?
I think it's, unfortunately, a lot of times with the UN, there's continuous reports of human rights violations before some sort of action item is taken into place. And I've seen this quite a bit, and my hopes are that I'm able to have some sort of an influence in that we're able to act up upon the human rights violations that are continuously occurring, especially under the name of, you know, religion or culture and what ISIS has been doing.
Absolutely, and I hope that we can move forward in the UN without being called Islamophobic for protecting the human rights of women and girls. Zainab Khan, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you.
My good friend Zainab Khan on with Katie Pavlich. That was past Saturday on Fox News on the Judge Jeanine Pirino show. She brings up some excellent points. In fact, if Zainab is able to come on, she's going to discuss at length this ISIS manifesto and the rigid code, the rigid quote-unquote ethical code for women who are members of ISIS or brides of ISIS. And she's also going to talk about the ISIS manifesto of selling human organs on the marketplace. And so she has some expertise in this area, and she's going to share that with us in hopefully the next week or so. Zainab has done such incredible work all over the world promoting human rights for women, the women that suffer. And so I hold Zainab in high esteem as a very powerful voice for the rights of women all over the world. What I want to do right now, I want to talk to you at length about the Free Yazidi Foundation, because we're talking about the war against women today, and I want to bring to your attention some facts about an organization that is reaching out for those who have been traumatized by ISIS, physically, spiritually. There is something that is being done for their benefit. It's called the Free Yazidi Foundation. Well, who are the Yazidis? The Yazidis are a peaceful religious group living in northern Iraq. They have lived in this part of the world for thousands of years. Followers of an ancient religion, the Yazidis, have historically faced persecution. And of course, you know about this. In August of this past year, ISIS terrorists began a genocidal attempt to eradicate all Yazidi men and kidnap Yazidi women. Many men, women, and children fled to Mount Sinjar, and the humanitarian disaster that ensued prompted the United States to attack ISIS positions around the mountain with airstrikes. Now, the Free Yazidi Foundation is designed to assist Yazidis that are in need. The foundation seeks to implement projects to protect and support the most vulnerable members of the Yazidi community, especially in Iraq and the Kurdistan region. Now, it's the Free Yazidi Foundation. Yazidi is spelled Y-E-Z-I-D-I. It's www.freeyazidi for more information. But what I want to do is speak to you about another aspect of this. This organization is based in the Netherlands. They operate in Kurdistan. Now, as a result of the ISIS attacks on the town of Sinjar and the areas in the Nineveh Plains, many Yazidi children lost their parents. And for this reason, the first major project undertaken by the Free Yazidi Foundation is the establishment of the Free Yazidi Foundation Children's Center and Post-Trauma Center. The Children's Center will be located in the province of Duhok and will cater to the many Yazidi children who have been left orphans because of the recent violence. By providing nurturing and basic needs to the greatest extent possible, Free Yazidi will work to help give these most vulnerable children a chance to live safe and healthy lives. Free Yazidi is grateful for donations, which are urgently needed to purchase and furnish the facility, pay for food and clothing, and cover the salaries of the caregivers. So this is wonderful. A children's center, orphans that have lost their parents in this horrible conflict that we saw this past summer and which really does continue. Now, civilians have suffered horribly as a result of ISIS attacks on the town of Sinjar and areas in the Nineveh Plains. The terrorists inflicted unspeakable atrocities against three populations, killing men and kidnapping women and young girls and subjecting them to horrible sexual violence. These innocent women are in need of post-trauma treatment and care once they flee or are rescued from ISIS control. The Free Yazidi Foundation will work with an international post-trauma treatment organization to provide services to those affected and train staff members to help civilians in need of the post-traumatic care. We are grateful, the Free Yazidi Foundation says, for donations to ensure the success of this urgently needed project. Let me give you this web address once again. It's the Free Yazidi Foundation, Yazidi spelled Y-E-Z-I-D-I. It's www.freeyazidi.com. I'm sure you'll find it. And please do all that you can to speak out, donate, and do what you can do to help these young children who don't have parents and these traumatized children, both men and young ladies and young men who have been raped and just mutilated by ISIS. And they're free. They've escaped, but they're not free spiritually. They're still in bondage to the trauma of being raped. These young girls just brutalized by this horrible, horrible group. And so the Free Yazidi Foundation is doing something about it. Well, what I want to do right now, I want to spend a few minutes with you. I want to spotlight particular cases of those Yazidi girls who escaped ISIS. This is about a 10-minute report, but it is worth every minute of your time to listen to it. We're going to learn more about the tragedy, the trauma, and the triumph of those that were freed from ISIS control and are trying to lead normal lives now. Let's listen right now on the cross in the desert.
We return now to the Islamic State group and their brutal tactics. Correspondent Marsha Biggs traveled to northern Iraq for the NewsHour to report on a group of girls who managed to escape from the terrorist group. But because of their psychological trauma and shame, they are still far from free. A warning, her report contains graphic images and subject matter.
Refugee camps dot the countryside in the Kurdish region of Iraq, where almost 2 million people have been forced from their homes. 29,000 people are living in this camp alone. Most of them are Yazidi, and almost all of them are missing family members. The Yazidis are a small ethnic minority of less than 1 million people, found primarily in northern Iraq. A private and conservative community, they practice an ancient religion. Last August, members of the Islamic State group, also known as ISIS or ISIL, attacked the Yazidis, whom they consider heretics. These pictures of Yazidis trapped on Sinjar Mountain stunned the world. Hundreds of thousands fled for their lives after IS fighters executed many of the men and took thousands of women and girls as slaves. This 13-year-old girl was taken and later escaped.
They brought everyone to a school and put the women upstairs and drove the men away. I didn't want to let my mother go, but they were pulling us from our mothers and beating us. The children were all put in cars. They said, "We're going to sell you to others, and you will have sex with them." The last time I saw my mother was when they took me away.
This video, which went viral last fall, appears to show an IS fighter bragging about the selling of girls. In the months that followed, a network of activists sprung up throughout northern Iraq, an underground railroad of sorts, coordinating rescue efforts. Their phone numbers quickly spread among captive girls who used smuggled phones to call for help and give their location. At times, the Kurdish regional government has stepped in to grease the wheels. KRG envoy Dr. Nuri Osman told us about two girls who escaped their captors in Raqqa and ran to a nearby house, but were turned away by the owner, too scared to take the chance.
I called the person, said, listen to me, please keep these two girls at your home for a couple of days. He said, no, I can't. I said, I'm going to pay you. Nobody is going to make an adventure with his life without doing something for him. You have to pay them.
Some families are raising money to buy back their girls, racking up thousands of dollars in debt.
Is the government funding a program to buy back the girls?
I'm not buying them, no. Maybe I'm paying some people, you know, they are helping me getting them back.
And so they're going into ISIS-controlled areas,
sure,
and infiltrating it.
Sure.
And getting these, and these
I'm
girls.
I'm sure some of them, they have relation with ISIS, or some of relatives, or some of relatives, and they are doing that. But I don't care. The important, I want these people to be back. These are my responsibility.
Dr. Nori says that his government has spent over $1.5 million to rescue the girls.
Do you face any ethical dilemma in the sense that the money that you would pay these people might somehow get into the hands of ISIS fighters?
Well, I'm not paying ISIS fighters. This is one. Second thing, these are Kurdish citizens, and I don't care where the money go personally. I care how to rescue the people.
As many as 400 Yazidi women and girls are now free and living in refugee camps like this one. But their nightmare is not over.
Most of them have been raped repeatedly. And in a culture where a woman's virginity is her badge of honor, no one wants to talk about it. But we found one brave girl who told us her whole story. Just 15 years old, she and her siblings were captured, separated, and for 4 months she was shuttled between towns and cities hundreds of miles apart, even being sent to Syria. In that first month, she and another girl were handed over to a man she calls the Sheikh.
He took us to his house, and for the night, he forced us to have sex with him.
He raped you?
Yes. He raped us together. We were together, the three of us, for the night. He told us, you don't have religion. I'm marrying you to make you the people of God.
What else did he say to you?
He said, we are married. You were mine. We will stay together and have children. If you try to escape or run away, you will get hurt and we might sell you.
They escaped through the help of a local mechanic who was able to get them a taxi. They were discovered at an Islamic State checkpoint and returned to the city of Mosul, where she was bought and sold again to a man who she says raped her over and over. He said bad words, ugly words. He told me, if you don't let me have sex with you, I'm going to sell you again. I'll send you to Syria where 10 men will be doing the same. And he beat us. She says she attempted suicide twice, the first by drinking bleach and the second by strangling herself with her scarf. During those dark days, she used a razor and a pen to tattoo herself with the words, Mamo Baba Ahabkom, which is Arabic for Mommy and Daddy, I love you. She says that's what kept her going.
You hadn't seen them for 4 months, and you didn't know where your sisters were?
No, I hadn't heard anything about my sisters.
She finally managed to escape once more through a small kitchen window. A family took her in until a taxi driver, paid by the local government, drove her north towards the town of Duhok. She says she walked the final hours on a road littered with bombs.
And she's still missing. And she's still missing as well.
Her four sisters and brother are still missing. Her mother can barely speak as we swipe through the pictures on her phone of her missing children.
Your son is still missing.
It's too dangerous for us to show you their faces. She may be back with her family, but like all the girls we met, she is suffering severe trauma with very few resources.
When you sleep at night, do you have bad dreams? Do you have nightmares?
Dr. Derek Farrell is a British psychotherapist working with a foundation that aims to open a trauma center for Yazidi girls. He told us some of the horror stories he's heard.
What has struck you the most?
Well, one is a level of sexual violence.
which is horrific. These are members of the Yazidi community where their faith is very important to them. And it's the fact that within their trauma, their faith is in some way being used against them, in a way which is very dehumanizing. A number of them felt that they wanted to kill themselves. Some of the women were given a gun by their ISIS captor and offered that they could kill themselves, but when they pushed the trigger, the gun was empty. You know, and it was the sheer, you know, humiliation, ridicule that went with that. These are girls who can't sleep. They're having bad nightmares. They're having flashbacks.
So many of the girls are afraid to admit that they were raped. They use the words honor and virginity interchangeably. This woman told me she'd gone to a doctor who performed a test to prove she was still a virgin. The Ministry of Health is trying to treat the girls both mentally and physically, but Dr. Nizar Ismet says less than half the girls who have returned have come in for a medical exam.
Is a virginity test part of this initial medical exam?
Not all the cases.
So you don't have to have a virginity test if you come for the medical evaluation?
No.
But I just wonder if that's maybe why some of the girls are staying away, because they're scared to have that test.
Yes, maybe one of the reasons, but we are not pushing anyone for this examination.
Some girls have had their hymens repaired, a sort of re-virginization surgery provided by the government for those that want it.
Did you have any kind of a surgery?
Yes. I had surgery to become a virgin.
Did you feel like you had to have that surgery?
Yes.
Why?
To return to that time when I was a virgin.
The priority is to provide good medical care, but some of them are hopeless because they say we lost our virginity, so we cannot marry again, for example, we cannot make a family. We don't want to disclose this to anyone of our family. They are really in a situation that is really a barrier for us to treat her or to overcome her traumas and depression.
Dr. Nizar would not confirm reports of underground abortions, but says that he is working with the court to try to find a way to make abortion legal for girls returning from captivity. Throughout the camp, we noticed the older women and the little girls, but very few young women. They prefer to stay inside.
Do you think that you will someday marry and have a family?
No. Because of what happened to me, I can't. I don't want to marry again. I can have a family, but I don't want to.
We ask her if there is anything that makes her happy now. The thought of meeting my brother and sisters again is the only thing, she says. For the little ones in the camp, there are smiles and laughter. They were spared the pain of their older sister's captivity. But they embark upon a life in a culture and a community which has been decimated by death and trauma. Marcia Biggs for PBS NewsHour, near Duhok, northern Iraq.
The PBS NewsHour doing a phenomenal job of bringing awareness to this traumatic situation. And before the segment, I talked to you a little bit about the Free Yazidi Foundation. You can go to my Facebook page, and you will see an internet address. It's a Twitter. You can follow them on Twitter. But do get involved to the best way that you know how, because I don't know of any other organization currently that is reaching out to the whole family like the Free Yazidi Foundation. And we're going to hear some more reports about this. I think we need to really be in touch with what's happening there in the Middle East and all over the world. And I think that the more we understand and the more we're made aware and educated, the more we can be responsive in what we can do to help. And many of us can just make awareness on our Facebook page. We can follow on Twitter. Others can invite guests on the radio program like myself. We can also donate. We can pray. We can be a voice. But these young children, as you heard in this report, are traumatized. Some of them want to take their life, and ISIS offering them a gun that's empty, and they have nightmares. I just can't imagine the brutal scars left on their souls for their entire life. And the Yazidi Foundation is offering trained counselors in a practical way to help them through these nightmares that most of them, unfortunately, could carry the rest of their life, the scars from abuse. Well, whatever you can do to help, link up with the Free Yazidi Foundation. We're going to hear one more report, and then I want to bring you to a person that's actually involved with the Free Yazidi. Her name is Pari Ibrahim. We're going to talk to her. But right now, let's listen to the NBC report on the Yazidi women who did escape slavery right now on the cross in the desert.
It is now well known that there is no mercy among the terrorists of ISIS. Often the men in areas they overrun are viciously murdered. But the women suffer a fate that may be worse than death. Sold into slavery, sometimes many times over, to suffer unimaginable brutality. Tonight, two victims who escaped their monstrous captors share their story with us. The report from our chief foreign correspondent, Richard Engel, in northern Iraq.
The suffering of the Yazidi people. Indelible images of men, women, and children reaching up for help, food, water, blankets, dropped on the Sinjar Mountain by helicopters, many of them American. But help didn't reach everyone. In the refugee camps of northern Iraq, we met survivors of the horror that went on in the village of Kuchu. Its people, seen here in better times, couldn't reach the mountain, so they were still in the village when ISIS arrived. When they took the men, we didn't know how many were going to be killed, says 19-year-old Farida, who didn't want her face to be shown. In fact, ISIS killed almost all of the men, but they had other plans for the women. They were grabbed by the hundreds and sold off to ISIS fighters as the spoils of war. ISIS is reviving the barbaric tradition of the slave trade, proudly showing its fighters in this ISIS video discussing the Yazidi women they're about to buy. We showed Farida the video. She instantly recognized the men. I saw that one and this guy, she said. I don't know their names, but I saw them. She saw them laughingly inspecting more than 80 Yazidi girls, picking out the ones they wanted. All of the girls were screaming and crying because they didn't want to go with them, she says. So they beat the girls and dragged them away by force. Farida was raped repeatedly for 3 months. They sold me from one man to the next, she says. The ordeal was even harder for the younger ones. They raped girls who were 9, 10 years old, or even 8, she says. They would say the older ones know something about men, while the younger ones know nothing. Hawaida is one of those innocents that the ISIS fighters sought out. She's just 12. She didn't know what rape meant, only that she woke up bleeding. He was old, she says, about the man who bought her. He was 50. Somehow, Hawaida escaped, but she's so badly traumatized that only now, 3 months later, is she able, haltingly, to even speak again. She and Farida are being coaxed back by this remarkable woman, Kiman Rashid, from a charity called Wadi. The girls call her mom. Their real mothers are still being held by ISIS. Farida had never seen the video of the ISIS men. I see this, she says, and I think of all the girls they still have because they are doing everything imaginable to them. We just want justice.
And Richard Engel joins us now from northern Iraq. This story, Richard, leaves one almost shaking with anger. You've seen so much in war zones. How did you process coming face to face with this particular atrocity?
Well, frankly, Lester, there's a word we don't use a lot in the news media, but it fits here. This is evil. It was absolute evil by design. This was not a war crime that happened by accident. This is ISIS policy. Now, luckily, these two girls amazingly managed to escape. They both walked away while their captors weren't looking. They had to walk for hours knocking on doors until they found people who are willing to bring them to a safe place. Now they are in a safe place here in northern Iraq, and they're getting help.
All right, Richard, I know they are getting help. You've written a lot more about this. It's on our website, but thank you for being with us tonight.
A very insightful report. These stories of the barbaric treatment of women having such a profound effect on the journalists on the ground, the newsmen that cover the stories, there's just no words to describe what these terrorists have done, this inhumane organization has done to the young children, the young ladies and men of our generation, the young girls, the young boys. What I want to do now is I want to bring you in touch with someone who works closely with the Free Yazidi Foundation. This is Pari Ibrahim, right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
More than 5,000 women and girls from the Yazidi sect in northern Iraq are being held as slaves by Islamic State. Many of them have been traded as wives for militants and are repeatedly raped. A very few have managed to escape, and their stories are harrowing. But there's been almost no attention to this story, and one Yazidi woman is now trying to change that by mounting a campaign for their release. Pari Ibrahim spoke to me earlier, and I started by asking her what exactly has happened to these women and girls.
The girls are being sold to Arab men, sold as sex slaves. Also, these girls have to convert to Islam and have the choice to marry ISIS men or being raped or being sold as sex slaves.
And you yourself have not yet met some of the Yazidi women who have escaped, but I understand that your brother has done.
Yeah, my brother went from the Netherlands to Sinjar. And before he went to fight with the Yazidi force, he went to some of these Yazidi girls who could flee ISIS. And it is horrible to hear the stories. They say they're being raped, and they are ashamed to even talk about these things. Abused and, all very horrible stories, and the world is a little bit silent about these things. And this should be front page news every day.
Pari, when your brother met the women who had escaped, are they all grown women, or are some of them younger? Are they teenagers as well?
No, young girls, 18, 20.
And these are girls who had not been married before, so they
no.
were taken up and sold effectively
yeah.
into marriage.
Not married, so virgin.
And do we know, Pari, obviously there's very little news coming out of northern Iraq and Syria because it's so dangerous for reporters to go there. Do we know what the situation of these women is today? Are they alive? Have they been killed? Are they still being held as prisoners?
Some of these girls can flee, and they are with open arms received by the families again. But many girls are still captured. We hear stories from Arabs who try to buy these girls and bring them back to the north of Iraq, Kurdistan area, where it's safe. We also hear that there are some of the Kurdistan region government, they are currently trying to buy these girls back.
So they have to pay a ransom, basically, to Islamic State.
Yeah, but not as Kurds. They buy them through Arabs. Arabs buy the girls and bring them back.
And why are the Arabs buying them? Just to get the cash?
It's more because ISIS trusts Arabs, and that's why they can...
I mean, it really sounds like a trade in human lives. It sounds like these women are being traded between the Arabs, between Islamic State, and as you said, the world has been far too silent about it. What are you trying to do to bring attention to this?
Well, I try everything. I do everything from the first day. I try to raise awareness through social media, but also we do a lot of demonstrations, shock demonstrations, to show the people what is happening with these girls. They are being sold on slave markets with chains in their necks, in their on their hands. So it is very inhuman.
Pari Ibrahim, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Pari Ibrahim is the founder of the Free Yazidi Foundation. She has a Facebook page as well, and you can go to the Free Yazidi Foundation link right now on my Facebook page. It will link you right now to Twitter. And so you really can get involved in so many ways, as I mentioned to you before. But as I'm sitting here thinking about the images of these children, I can see the chains. And I don't want to see their lives ruined forever by the scars and the trauma. And that's why I'm excited that this foundation exists now to reach out to the orphans, to the ones that have been brutalized, who no longer have parents because of ISIS, to the ones that have been raped, that have managed to escape these brutalizers but are trying to live now a normal life again and are facing nearly impossible circumstances. And so the Free Yazidi Foundation can bring hope to these children and to bring a new beginning to these children. And as I'm thinking of the term hope and the whole image of hope and freedom, I, of course, think about a book I wrote a year or so ago called Beauty from the Ashes, The Promise Fulfilled. And let me tell you how this relates to our topic this morning about the Yazidis, the war on women. Beauty from the Ashes is actually the sequel to a book I wrote called The Promise. It's the story of two young Jewish girls growing up during World War II in the Warsaw Ghetto and how this incredible historical event shaped their lives, with the Germans coming in, of course, sealing off a section of the city and putting a select group of Jewish people, almost about 500,000, behind this wall, separating them from the other Polish people and some of the more affluent Jewish people. And so this Warsaw Ghetto was a place to starve, to eventually kill this sect of the Jewish people. Many of them were deported away to the concentration camps out of the Warsaw Ghetto. Some, fortunately, were able to escape to the other side of the wall and be hidden by some Polish families for a price, of course. And they had to try to have a new life in spite of the genocide of the Jewish people going on before their eyes. In this book, The Promise, was the story of Hannah and Rachel. I wrote it to pay tribute to the many suffering victims of the Holocaust. And it's the story of this young friendship. They promised each other that after the war, if possible, they would meet again. And it's the story of Hannah being separated from her best friend, Rachel. Now, the sequel to this is the story of their reunion more than 40 years later. But the problem is that Rachel, Hannah's best friend, is traumatized. And it's the story of how God takes the trauma of our life, the broken pieces of our lives, and mends them back together again, as only He can do. And that's why I called it Beauty from the Ashes, subtitle, The Promise Fulfilled. It's not only the reunion of Hannah and Rachel, but it's the story of how God is working in their individual life to heal them of the scars and bring beauty out of the ashes of their suffering. And so I want to read a little bit from my book and talk to you about this concept of beauty from the ashes. But before I do that, I want to play this song for you by Stephen Curtis Chapman, a very familiar name in contemporary Christian music, who about 7 years ago faced an incredible tragedy, and yet beauty rose out of that tragedy. And this is why the song is called Beauty Will Rise. Here's a song of hope for you right now on the cross in the desert.
Out of these ashes, beauty will rise. For we know for my face to wipe the tears away. They say it's time to make everything new.
Curtis Chapman from his CD, Beauty Will Rise, a song of triumph and of healing and grace. Beauty will rise as God takes the emptiness, the brokenness, and makes something brand new out of the evil done to our lives. Got a phone call right now on the cross in the desert. I'm going to take this, and I don't know who this is. We're going to find out. Good morning, and welcome to the cross in the desert.
Hey, Randy, it's Teresa.
Well, hi, this is my friend Teresa.
I wanted to tell you thank you for sharing about the book Beauty. I just absolutely love that book, and so special to me. And I just wanted to tell you thank you for talking about that.
Well, thank you. Teresa is my good friend who has actually a ministry called Beauty from the Ashes. She helps broken people through her teachings and through her many blogs that she writes about God's beauty, bringing something good out of our tragedies. You know, Teresa, this morning we're talking about the trauma and the hurt of the Yazidi children who were raped by ISIS and how God can bring beauty out of the ashes of their suffering. There's a foundation called the Free Yazidi Foundation that's helping these kids. But you have ministry. You have an important ministry to the broken people as well. Share with us a little bit about that.
I just wish that I had more opportunities to take the message. It includes so many different things. The story of the woman who broke the alabaster box, and she went past her fears. And she went in there and exposed herself to Yeshua, and the whole room was filled with the scent of the perfume that she poured on him. And he blessed her, and he made sure that that this woman was remembered throughout history. He wanted her remembered, and that is so special that here are these young girls that you were talking about, and all the horrible things that have happened to them, And my prayer is that they will come to Yeshua in their brokenness.
Yes. Yes, and you're referring to a story in the Gospels where this woman of quote-unquote ill repute came into this setting where Jesus was at, and the religious leaders are there watching Jesus. How can you even have anything to do with this sinful woman? And yet she anointed him for his burial, breaking the alabaster box. And your point is, when we come to Jesus with our brokenness, that he restores it.
Yeah. And there are a few other things in my teaching that illustrate the idea of broken to beauty. There is this beautiful garden in Vancouver Island. It's called Bouchard Gardens. And the whole history of that is something that I bring up in my teaching. The originally it was a big pit that this woman's husband used to quarry limestone, and this land was destroyed, and it was like a 50-foot pit that was just barren and nothing growing, and she started planting seeds outside of her door, and when her husband had quarried all the limestone out of the hole, she asked him if that could become a garden. And he agreed and started hiring his workers to bring dirt in and help her plant. And they changed this into one of the top 10 gardens in the world right now. There's like over a million people go to visit it every year. And it is incredible. I went online and research is absolutely incredible. And also, one of the illustrations that I use is the Kintsukuri pottery that is from Japan, where they take broke pottery and mend it with gold. And I see that gold as being Jesus filling in the cracks, and it makes these broken things more beautiful than they were before. So that's my prayer for these girls. That gold will fill them and make them beautiful and help them to overcome, that Jesus will lift them up. So anyway, I just want to share that with you.
Thank you. That is a good illustration. Excuse my voice here for a second, all of a sudden, being attacked here. But no, Teresa, thank you for calling, because you're reminding us how the concept of broken to beautiful is so real, that this pit became this beautiful garden. And I think your point is, in the greatest pits of our life, the pits of despair, the pits of brokenness, when we plant the seeds of the Word of God, a great garden, a harvest as a result.
Right. Absolutely. Anyway, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Teresa. God bless you. Thank you for calling in. That's my good friend Teresa, who has a ministry of helping people with their brokenness realize the beauty of God again. I want to take this time, because Teresa mentioned my book, Beauty from the Ashes, and quote from chapter 13, where Hannah returns to Auschwitz to face her fears. And I want to do that here. Chapter 13 begins with these words. The dark rain clouds swirled overhead. Hannah buttoned up the collar of her gray raincoat and tried to keep warm as a cold mist splashed against her face. She was alone and face to face once again with the camp of death, the hellhole that devastated the lives of millions of innocent Jews, Auschwitz. Her stomach churned. She felt nauseated and trembling with fear, but Hannah knew she had to finally confront the demons that had stolen her life so many years ago. The steel front gates, faded and chipped from the many years of weather and erosion, still announced in big, bold letters, quote, Auschwitz, Birkenau II. Below the welcome sign was, Abriet macht frei, meaning works bring freedom. Hannah steadied her balance and leaned against the steel gate, feeling dizzy. Auschwitz was anything but freedom. It was a pit of fear, death, and oppression. It was a place of unimaginable cruelty, where the crime of the century. Composing herself, Hannah took a deep, agonizing breath and struggled to continue. Passing through the front gate, Hannah gazed at the endless barbed wire fence that surrounded the death camp. The guards' towers were still towering above the fence, broken and displaying years of weather erosion. Hannah remembered that near the end, many prisoners, despaired of all hope, hurled their bodies against the barbed wire and were instantly electrocuted, ending their lives and escaping from the horrible, unjust suffering. The ground was still muddy. Hannah remembered the endless hours of standing in the rain and cold for a roll call until every prisoner was accounted for. Many of the prisoners, weak and ill, collapsed from standing at attention and died from exhaustion. In a matter of minutes, Jewish prisoners were ordered to dispose of the body and haul them away in a wooden cart. Hannah stopped. Drops of cold rain splashed across her face. The air was becoming cold. Hannah bundled up in her rain jacket. In the distance, Hannah could see row after row of the blockhouses out across the muddy grounds. The blockhouses were converted horse stables where thousands of prisoners were crammed together, sometimes four to a bunk, in filthy and poorly heated death houses. Hannah gazed at the palms of her hands and remembered the cracks, the sores and blisters that tormented her from breaking rocks and bricks every day. The hard labor began at 6 a.m. and lasted sometimes until 7 p.m. that same night, enduring bleak, breaking, intense work with very little food and water. She witnessed many of her friends collapsing and dying from disease and exhaustion after laboring 13 hours a day. It began raining harder. The wind was whipping across Hannah's face. She bundled up tightly in her raincoat. Over to the left was an ominous and painful sight. Hannah gazed at the steel railroad tracks that ran up to the entrance of Auschwitz. Although faded by the weather and many years of soiled erosion, the steel tracks still shined as a grim reminder of the thousands of Jews that were transported like cattle from far away in Warsaw. Hannah stepped closer to the tracks, remembering how the Germans with their guard dogs seized the passengers out of the freight cars and divided them into two separate lines, one line for hard labor and the other line to immediate death in the gas chambers. Hannah recalled how she and Sophie fortunately were pushed together in a line for hard labor. "Oh, Sophie," Hannah mumbled to herself in tears, her voice trembling. "I miss you so much, dear friend." Hannah moved on toward the barracks. It was much too painful to dwell at the train tracks any longer. Bundling up against the weather, Hannah pushed open the door to the barracks. She walked inside and switched on a ceiling light. In front of her were old wooden barracks laden with cobwebs and spiders. The bunk beds towered three high up toward the ceiling. Hannah steadied herself against the railing of the bunk bed, overcome with grief. She remembers sleeping on the top bunk with Sophie and three other women squeezed together. Hannah could still hear the moaning, the cursing, and the coughing. Many of the other women were sick from not having food and water for three long and agonizing days in the freight cars. Tears of sorrow streamed down Hannah's face. She rubbed her eyes and began to pray, crying out to grief to Hashem. She remembered praying and comforting Gabriella the first night at Auschwitz. Gabrielle had watched her sister die in the freight car. The next morning, when she had tried to wake up Gabrielle, she remembered how cold her body was to touch. Gabriella had died during the night. Hannah stared down at the walls next to the bunk beds. Many prisoners had written or etched messages on the walls. "Welcome to hell. There is no escape. There is no God. There is no way out of here." Hannah turned her head away in despair. She felt an empty bitterness and sorrow flooding her souls. Facing her demons was more overwhelming than she ever imagined. Hannah had to move on quickly. Stepping out of the barracks, Hannah was relieved to see that the rain had stopped. She looked ahead in the distance. There was a two-story building with chimneys on the roof. Hannah immediately recognized it, place of hell and death. Sophie had been brought here that one awful, grim, and rainy day. She had been escorted here with 50 other women to be gassed. Hannah grabbed her chest in anxiety. She felt her heart flutter as pains shot across her chest. She didn't know if she could endure going inside, but she knew she had to go. Hannah wanted to once and for all confront the ultimate dark chambers of horror. Here is where her best friend died over 40 years ago. Hannah had to go and be with her this one last time to say goodbye and find closure. Shortly before the war ended, when the Germans realized they were going to lose, they destroyed most of the buildings containing the gas chambers in order to conceal their sick and despicable crimes against humanity. However, there was one building that still remained standing at Auschwitz, testifying to the unspeakable crimes that the Germans committed against innocent Jewish people. Hannah turned the handle on the door and walked inside. It was ominously quiet and vacant. She heard the sound of shoes squeaking as she stepped onto the shiny linoleum floor. Aside from a few dim ceiling lights, the corridor was shrouded in a dark and eerie glow. There was a sign and an arrow pointing toward a door indicating the location of the shower rooms where people were gassed. During an execution, a person was appointed to stand on the roof above and drop poisonous pellets down a metal chute, landing on the floor of the shower room below. Men, women, and children were ordered to strip naked and herded together into a fake shower room. Within a few minutes, tiny pellets struck the floor and the room was engulfed in a poisonous cloud of gas, slowly suffocating the naked victims. Intense screaming and yelling could be heard beyond the shower walls as the victims desperately tried to breathe and stay alive. The ominous sound of footsteps descending down the stairs sent chills up and down Hannah's spine. She couldn't believe she was actually going down in the basement where thousands of Jews were murdered, and yet Hannah knew she had to do this. Reaching the bottom, Hannah gazed at the dark and cold concrete walls. There was a tiny shaft of light above, illuminating the cold, death-like basement. Hannah was seized by cold chills as she stared ahead at the door in front of her. This was a room of death. The death or the door that led to the shower room of merciless executions. Hannah began to tremble with fear. Behind the door where her best friend Sophie bravely struggled for her survival more than 40 years ago and lost the battle. She had no chance of survival. She had been led like a lamb to the slaughter. Hannah stood in the dark corridor surrounded by four cracked, cold concrete walls that seemed to stare back at her as if she was the next victim. Suddenly, Hannah felt trapped. Sweat rolled down her forehead. Her heart began to race. "Sophie! Sophie!" Hannah cried. "I'm so sorry! I'm so sorry!" Hannah covered her face in tears. She couldn't open up the door. She felt guilty for being so broken and afraid. "I wish I could have been here with you, Sophie, and held you in my arms. Please forgive me," Hannah sobbed intensely. Then, in the midst of her agony, deep down inside of her spirit, a voice seemed to rise up and get her attention. "Hannah," the voice gently said, beckoning her. "Hannah," the voice said again. Hannah struggled to compose herself. "Hannah, listen to me. Don't be afraid. Don't be sad anymore." Hannah slowly began to quiet down and stop sobbing. "Yeshua?" Hannah replied. "Yeshua, is that you?" "Hannah, don't be afraid of this dark place. In this dark and evil place, over 40 years ago, I was here. I was with Sophie." Suddenly, Hannah stopped sobbing. A river of peace seemed to pour down over her and cleanse her soul. She was no longer afraid. "In her dying moments, I held Sophie in my arms. She is no longer afraid. She is now with me." Tears of joy flooded Hannah's eyes. "Yes, yes, Shua, she is with you. Hannah, I know all about pain and suffering. I experienced rejection, betrayal, and excruciating death. Hannah, I gave my life for you and Sophie and millions of others. I embrace the worst of pain and suffering for your forgiveness, Hannah. Don't weep, be afraid. I love you with an everlasting love. I am bringing beauty out of the ashes of your suffering." The voice of Yeshua comforting Hannah, confronting her demons at Auschwitz. This is the same voice of hope for for you that are suffering and broken. This is the same voice of hope for all of those suffering Yazidi children traumatized by ISIS. Do not be afraid. I am with you. I will hold you in my arms of love, is the promise of Jesus to you. This is the segment of the program that I always look forward to, the latest story from my dear friend, Paymaneh, who lives as a Christian Iranian refugee in Malaysia. I asked her just recently to write the story of what a prisoner felt as she was going to be executed in Iran. Since Rouhani took office over a year ago, executions have tripled and spiked. Over thousands have been executed under his watch. This is the story written in the first person of a female prisoner about to be hanged in Iran, and I want you to listen. Door. Next time that you groan with your metal sound to open, you will open to my death, the death of my body. My soul was killed tonight. This dirty marriage killed me. Tonight that you opened for me to exit, I did not think that a nightmare worse than death was waiting for me. I did not know that I would be the most pitiful bride in the world. I wish you had never opened tonight. I wish the long hours would pass soon and my body be hanged, the dirt of my body and soul to be cleansed. The first time when you opened, I don't know how many endless days ago, I thought this solitary cell would be the end of the world. It is, but not the very end. There was something worse than this solitary and death waiting for me. This dirty, imposed so-called marriage is the most terrible thing in the world. Like all other things, like my confessions to the crimes I'd never committed, like being tortured to sign my confession, like breaking my hunger strike by feeding me from the toilet, by hanging me by my hands and beating my stomach with your knees and boots, like telling lies to my family, being cruel to my family to protect them, like telling lies on TV, admitting how guilty I am when I am not, like confessing to having a relationship and communication with people who I've never seen, and putting them in danger. The first time door you opened to me, you welcomed me, I was really scared. Scared of you. Scared of death. Scared of the noose. Scared of the rope. Scared of everything. Scared of darkness, of grave. Now I am numb. I have no feeling, no fear. Now I am looking forward to death. I don't want this dirty life anymore, full of offense, full of humiliation, full of beating, full of dirty men, full of nasty words, dirty hands, nasty touches, full of tiredness, darkness, solitary, enmity, threat. I do not want this dirty life anymore. I want this intolerable nightmare to stop. I tolerated all unbearable things. Now I want to sleep, sleep, sleep. Since they kept me hanging and slapped me when I fell asleep, I wanted to sleep. I have dreamed of sleeping since they forced me to stand all night and poured water on me when I fell asleep. Last month, they flogged my body. Tonight, they flogged my soul. Tonight was extremely painful. Door, you have more empathy than these men's. Your ears hear better than these men's. I want to sleep. I prefer to talk to you, door. I don't want to talk to any human being anymore. I don't want to hear any human voice anymore. I just want to rest, to sleep deeply, to sleep death. I don't want to hear any footsteps. I don't want to. No sound of the metal door, anybody crying, any men's sounds, any humiliating sounds. I just want to die. The things I went through were beyond my imaginations. I was a simple girl loving people, having a simple life. Suddenly, I'm faced with courts, unfair judges, injustice, nasty words I hear every day, nasty guys offending me every day. It's too much for me. The dirty hands touching me, beating me every day, the legs and knees hitting me are too much for me. I do not deserve this. I never thought I would be chained to a bed in a hospital like a dangerous murderer. Well, I don't even have the energy to speak. I never thought I would put the life of my family at risk for loving people, defending their rights. I never imagined I had to admit to a crime that I'm not guilty of committing and have to pay the price, death for it. I was forced to confess on TV. This is the way they made me famous. While I wanted to be a famous journalist, not a criminal, they made me ruin the lives of families whom I've never seen, who never met me, never hurt me. I ruined their life by confessing to a relationship with men I didn't have. Now I just want to die. I love this time. I won't breathe anymore. I love the time when God will hold me in his arms. But what if God punishes me because of all the forced lies I told, all dirty confessions, all pain I imposed to a family and to others, to my mother? Well, what is she doing now? They don't even allow me to see her, to say goodbye to her. God will punish me for all the pain I gave to my parents and my sister. I'm so sorry, Mother. I wanted to defend humanity, but I was not even able to protect you. I gave all of the pain of those humans to you, Mother. I never intended to hurt you or anybody else. Mother, it's too dark here. I don't know what the color of the walls even are. Father, your big kind hands always patted me. These guys have taught me that hands can be painful too. You always protected me. These men's taught me that hands can be unsafe too. Father, whenever you opened the door to enter home, you brought me the promise of warmth, joy, security, and happiness. During these years in jail, whenever a door opens, there's a message of unsafe, cruelty, and torturing waiting for me. There's the sound of footsteps. They're coming to take me. I don't want to die. I'm scared. I don't want to die anymore. I don't want this door to open. I want to stay in this darkness forever, just not die. I'm scared. Mother, help me. Father, where are you? I must be strong. Be strong, girl. You are strong. Be strong. Don't show your fear to these ugly men. The women are taking me into the noose. They're very scary. They are covering my eyes with a blindfold. No sympathy. I don't want your sympathy. But at least you can say something to help me. These women, they're messenger of death. I'm afraid of them. My shoulders are shaking. I don't want anyone to see me shaking. My legs don't shake. It's just one more minute. Then the suffering is over. There's no more pain. Is the rope painful? I'm scared. Is this painful? God, please, please kill me. Please kill me before I see the rope. I don't want to die that way. I don't want to die hanging. I don't want to struggle for breath. I don't want to be among these cruel strangers. God, I'm afraid. Mother, Father, I am afraid. I have a strange feeling. Maybe it's not fear, but something strange. Maybe because I'm worried because I did not see your face, Mother, for the last time. Maybe I'm worried for your pain. My lips are shaking. It's better to pray. Let them see me praying, not shaking, not frightened. There is a voice. Two women are crying from afar. Is that you, Mother? Please don't cry. You make me afraid. I hope you're going to be okay. God, please kill me before the rope touches my neck. I don't want to seem weak. I'm climbing steps. These must be the last steps. I cannot believe that. I wish it were night here. I want to wake up. Wake up. Please wake up. God, I'm not guilty. I can't believe they are killing me. I'm innocent. God, will you allow them to do that? Oh, God, this rope is too thick. Oh, God, I feel like I'm in hell. Stop it. Finish it soon. Is it possible they will change their decision by a miracle and let me live? My mother is crying. My mother? My sister should? Oh, God. I cannot breathe. Well, I think we're having some technical difficulties here. My page has become unresponsive, and I'm hoping that I will be back online. I don't know if I'm actually transmitting right now because, according to my computer, it says the shockwave has crashed. And so that means one of the plugins is not working, and so I've lost our Yeah, here we go again. Wow. Something just bizarre happened right in the middle of a dramatic reading. I cannot believe this. But somehow my blog talk was frozen, and those things do happen. I apologize for that interruption, but it looks like our time is continuing. That was an incredible story by my dear friend Payman A. from Malaysia, describing what it would be like for a political prisoner on her way to be hanged in Iran. And I hope that you could somehow emotionally connect with that to just get a feel of what these poor Iranians suffer with every day. I don't know. I'll have to listen back to our blog talk if our story went out over the air, because we had a little incident here on the blog talk. I hope it did. But at any rate, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on The Cross in the Desert. What I want to do is ask you to come to my Facebook page, Randy L. Noble. And if you're not my friend, please friend request me and enjoy the postings I have on my page, but particularly the one about the Free Yazidi Foundation. Please connect with them, because they are reaching out to these abused children that have been sexually abused by ISIS and giving them hope once again. And so if anything that you listen to on this program, if you didn't get anything out of anything, I hope that you connect with the Free Yazidi Foundation, because they're a wonderful organization, brand new, situated in the Netherlands, and they reach out to those hurting in Kurdistan. They can be a lifeline of hope for the Yazidi people. So I appreciate your time today of joining me. And please stay tuned this Thursday. Hopefully and prayerfully, we will have a very special guest from Fox News on my program, Lisa Deftari. I'm hoping that will happen. I apologize for any technical difficulties in the last couple of minutes. Thank you so much. God bless you. Thank you for listening today to The Cross in the Desert. I will see you on Thursday. Have yourself an incredible week.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming down.